Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Ann Ball. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Efforts by European nations to find ways for businesses to work around United States sanctions on Iran are unlikely to succeed. Diplomats and experts say those efforts are likely to face difficulties after the Iranian government's decision to violate its 2015 nuclear deal with world powers. The International Atomic Energy Agency reported on Monday that Iran breached the agreed limit on its supply of low-enriched uranium. The experts say the financial mechanism developed by European nations that signed the deal will not provide Iran with enough to make up for the loss of trade and oil sales. U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew the United States from the nuclear deal last year. He said that the deal did little to prevent Iran from making a nuclear weapon. He also noted that the country continued to support conflicts in the Middle East. The U.S. sanctions prevent Iran from using Western financial markets. Some European nations have hoped to develop a system to help Iran avoid measures barring it from international trade. France, Germany, and Britain developed the mechanism to trade with Iran legally. All three countries signed the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran. China and Russia also signed the agreement. The trading system is known as the Instrument in Support of Trade Exchanges, or INSTEX. It is designed to permit countries to trade with Iran through what is described as a barter system. Sales are carried out without the use of United States dollars, so as to avoid the U.S. financial system. However, the International Atomic Energy Agency confirmed this week that Iran had knowingly enriched more than 300 kilograms of uranium. That is the limit set by the 2015 nuclear deal. Iranian officials announced last month that they would enrich more uranium than the amount permitted under the agreement. The officials also warned that they plan to enrich uranium to a higher level by July 7th. They said, however, that level is still below the 90% purity needed for uranium to be used as a fuel for a weapon. The U.S. government has denounced Iran's uranium enrichment program. Trump recently tweeted that Iran is playing with fire. The administration has said it would never allow Iran to develop nuclear weapons. Many European companies were concerned about doing business with Iran before the country breached its nuclear limit. Brian Hook, the U.S. Special Representative for Iran, noted last Friday that if you look at trading volumes, the EU does more trade with Kazakhstan than it does with Iran. He added that Europe does not have much demand for Iranian products. Instex's designers say it was meant to trade in basic goods like food, medicine, and humanitarian aid. But Iran has said that is not enough. It wants to use Instex to sell oil. Henry Rome is with the Eurasia Group, a research organization. He described Instex this way. It's basically a barter system. They, the Iranians, had high expectations that it could handle such things as oil. Iran is suspected of secretly selling crude oil to China, but most of the money it earns from oil sales has disappeared because of the U.S. sanctions. For many companies, the risk of facing sanctions because of trade with Iran outweighs any gain from trading with Iran. Also, most of Iran's top businesses are tied to government-linked groups, like the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The U.S. measures target that group specifically. Now, some European countries find themselves in a difficult position. Should they take actions designed to punish Iran or try to save the 2015 nuclear deal? I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Summertime in the U.S. usually means slower days and no school.
Yes, summer, my time of year.
Teachers know, however, that summer vacation means students will likely fall behind and forget things they learned during the year. Simon Vanderpool, a special education teacher in Lexington, Kentucky, decided to do something about it. He started a program called Books and Barbers. Children go to the barber, choose a book, and read out loud while the barber cuts their hair. The child gets a sticker and can take the book home. And there is an added bonus. Money. The kids get paid to read. The program is for children ages about 5 to 12. There's no limit to the number of haircuts they can get. Vanderpool says barber shops are places where kids can feel comfortable.
Once the student feels comfortable, that's whenever their brain opens up and that they're able to start focusing on nothing but learning.
He says last year, teachers at his school noticed a huge difference between kids who were in summer reading programs and those who were not. Austin Lopez is 7 years old. In the fall, he will be in second grade. His mom, Amanda Lopez, brings him to Prince Cut's Barbershop
in Lexington. First, Austin says, he chooses a book from the shelf full of colorful ones.
Well, then I go on a chair to go to the barber, get my hair cut. And then while he's doing my haircut, I read the book.
And what does he like about reading?
That you get to learn.
This day, he will be reading a book about the popular cartoon Angry Birds. The books for the program are donated by fellow teachers, people who heard about the program, and the International Book Project. Austin's favorite books are encyclopedias. Sometimes, he says, he is a little worried about reading out loud.
Sometimes I get words wrong in it, those books I like.
That is where the barber can help. Amir Shalash owns the barber shop, but he is doing more than cutting Austin's hair. He is listening to him read and helping him with his reading. Shalash says all the children ask for help, and that opens a chance to connect.
They reach out to us, and they're like, what's this word say? And we'll help them out, you know, kind of give them, you know, a little insight on it. And we engage with the story, so it's like we'll listen to what they're saying, and we'll kind of engage back with it, kind of get them into the book a little bit more.
Austin's mom, Amanda Lopez, praises the program.
They truly encourage reading, which my son loves to read, and he, you know, education is truly important for all of us parents.
Shalash says the money gives the children a good reason to try reading out loud. The parent is charged $16 for the haircut, and the child is given $3, either to spend right away or to save for something later. Simon Vanderpool says the money provides an important lesson about saving.
The overall picture of giving that is to not only increase their engagement within the program, but to also see the lesson of being able to save money and to invest their money as well.
Austin Lopez is saving his money to buy a new Lego toy set. Most of the children getting haircuts at barbershops are boys. Vanderpool's idea was to do more than just help them with reading and money. The teacher wants to help kids who are growing up in a home without a father, like he did.
Also, I created the program in order to provide a positive mentor for the kids that go into the barbershop and are able to have someone that they can rely on and they can trust in and just build a bond between the two of them.
The organization fatherhood.org reports that at least one in four American children lives without their father in the home. Austin Lopez's mom says having a man pay attention and listen to her son is helpful.
As a single mom, I definitely love how the guys in the barbershop, they actually reach out to our kids and they actually try to be in their lives. That means a lot to me, and I know my son as well.
Shalash says he and his fellow barbers like being mentors.
The biggest thing is that we try to influence as many kids as we can, and that was my whole intention of it.
Vanderpool is spreading the program to more barbershops in Lexington and in Ohio. He is also talking with hair salons to start programs aimed at girls. And he has started a new nonprofit to bring professional athletes to barbershops to read with children. In the fall, Vanderpool begins his second year of teaching. This time, He will be working in a high school. He, the barbers, the parents, and the children all believe that the students' reading levels will show that they took the time to read this summer. And when he starts second grade, Austin Lopez should do well in reading, as well as in his favorite subject, math. I'm Ann Ball.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The months before Election Day in November of 1980 were difficult for President Jimmy Carter. Many Americans blamed the Democrat for the nation's economic problems, including high inflation and high unemployment. Many also blamed him for not gaining the release of 52 American hostages in Iran. About a year earlier, Muslim extremists had seized the United States Embassy in Tehran and taken the Americans as prisoners. President Carter urged all Americans to support his administration during the crisis. As the months went by, however, he made no progress in bringing the hostages home. The Iranians rejected negotiations for their release, and an attempt to rescue them failed. The president appeared powerless. Carter's political weakness led another Democrat, Ted Kennedy, to compete against him for the party's nomination. The Republican Party, however, was united behind a strong candidate, Ronald Reagan, a former actor and former governor of California. Reagan's running mate for vice president was George H.W. Bush. Bush had served in Congress and as head of the Central Intelligence Agency. He had also represented the United States as ambassador to China and to the United Nations. The inability of the Carter administration to solve the hostage crisis and other problems made many Americans feel that their country was weak. Reagan promised to give them confidence once more in the nation's strength. Carter and Reagan debated each other several weeks before the election. To some people, Carter seemed angry and defensive, while Reagan seemed calm and thoughtful.
Next Tuesday is Election Day. Next Tuesday, all of you will go to the polls and make a decision. I think when you make that decision, it might be well if you would ask yourself, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Is it easier for you to go and buy things in the stores than it was 4 years ago? Is there more or less unemployment in the country than there was 4 years ago? Is America as respected throughout the world as it was? And if you answer all of those questions yes, why then I think your choice is very obvious as to who you'll vote for. If you don't agree, if you don't think that this course that we've been on for the last 4 years is what you would like to see us follow for the next four, then I could suggest another choice that you have.
On Election Day, voters gave Reagan a huge victory. It became known as the Reagan Revolution. Inauguration Day was January 20th, 1981. Ronald Reagan became the nation's 40th president and, at 69, the oldest ever elected. In his inaugural speech, the new president talked about the goals of his administration. A major goal was to reduce the size of the federal government. Reagan and other conservatives believed that the nation's economy was suffering because of high taxes and unnecessary laws. Government, he said, was not the solution to the problem. Government was the problem. He urged Americans to join him in what he called a new beginning.
The economic ills we suffer have come upon us over several decades. They will not go away in days, weeks, or months, but they will go away. They will go away because we, as Americans, have the capacity now, as we've had in the past, to do whatever needs to be done to preserve this last and greatest bastion of freedom.
Ronald Reagan was born in 1911 in the small community of Tampico, Illinois. He was a good student and a good athlete. While in college, he became interested in acting. But he did not have enough money to go to New York or Hollywood to study to become an actor. Instead, he tried out for a job as a sports announcer on radio. A radio station in Davenport, Iowa, liked his creativity and gave him the job. Later, Dutch Reagan, as he was called, worked at a radio station in Des Moines, Iowa, and then he moved to the big city, Chicago, where he worked as an announcer for the Chicago Cubs baseball team. In March of 1937, the Cubs were in California for spring training. Reagan went along, and while he was there, he took a screen test with Warner Brothers. The movie studio liked the friendly, handsome young man and offered him a job. Before long, Ronald Reagan was a Hollywood star. In the 1940 film Canute Rockne, All-American, Reagan played Notre Dame University college football player George Gipp. His deathbed speech contained a line that would often be associated with the Reagan presidency.
Ask them to go in there with all they've got. Win just one for the Kipper. I don't know where I'll be then, but I'll know about it. I'll be happy.
In King's Row, Reagan played a double amputee who had lost both legs.
Randy! Randy! Where's the rest of me? Randy!
Yes, Drake?
It was that accident.
Yes, dear. But don't talk about it yet.
He remembered King's Row as the film that made him a star. During World War II, Reagan joined what was then the Army Air Corps and made training films. Reagan became deeply interested in politics during his years in Hollywood. He started out a liberal, but his political views became increasingly conservative. He served six times as president of the Screen Actors Guild, a union of movie actors. After the war, Reagan guided the Screen Actors Guild through a frightening time for actors and others in the entertainment industry. It was the time of the powerful House Un-American Activities Committee. Its hearings resulted in the feared blacklist. The blacklist was responsible for hurting, even ending, the careers of many in the film and television industries if they were thought to be communists or to have communist sympathies. It was through the blacklist scare that Reagan met his second wife, Nancy Davis. Her name had mistakenly been confused with that of another actress, causing it to appear on a blacklist, and she sought Reagan's help in correcting the mistake. They fell in love, and would marry in 1952.
Must be a big push this time, Case.
The Admiral told me not to tell.
Reagan and Nancy Davis appeared together in the World War II drama Hellcats of the Navy, in which he played a naval officer and she a Navy nurse who loved him.
The Admiral should have told me not to worry.
I thought we settled all that about you and me.
It won't stay settled, Case. Not until you tell me you stopped caring.
By the early 1950s, Reagan stopped appearing in movies and turned instead to a new medium, television.
And every Sunday night, General Electric brings you the finest motion picture stars on TV.
For many years, Ronald Reagan was the commercial spokesman for General Electric and host of a series of dramatic shows. For much of his life, Ronald Reagan was a Democrat. But by 1960, he was making speeches for conservative Republican candidates. In 1966, he became a candidate himself. He ran as a Republican for governor of California. Democrats did not take him seriously. They made fun of some of his movie roles, as in Bedtime for Bonzo, a comedy where his co-star was a chimp. But Reagan had the last laugh. He won the election by almost a million votes. As governor, Reagan was praised for reducing the state's debt, but criticized for raising taxes. Some people also thought he reacted too strongly against student unrest on college campuses. But he won re-election in 1970. In 1976, Reagan ran for the Republican presidential nomination. He came close to winning that nomination away from President Gerald Ford. After accepting the nomination, Ford asked Reagan to share the stage with him. The strong welcome that Reagan received was a clear sign of his future in the party. That future would come just 4 years later when Reagan won the presidency. On Reagan's inauguration day, Iran finally released the hostages it had been holding for 444 days. Walter Cronkite paused in his CBS television coverage of the inauguration for this breaking news report from Dan Rather.
Walter, according to our CBS News sources at Tehran Airport, one of the two Algerian jetliners is taxiing, or was just a few moments ago. Now, as best we can make it out, here is where the situation with the American hostages stands at this moment. They remain in Tehran, or at least they were up until just a few moments ago at the airport, apparently moments away from their flight to freedom, a few moments after spending 444 days in captivity. And can you imagine what it must have been like inside that airliner for the hostages this morning?
As president, Ronald Reagan quickly began work to get Congress to reduce taxes. He also began a weekly series of radio broadcasts. Each Saturday, he would comment on developments in American life and politics. Reagan's ability to relate to people earned him the nickname the Great Communicator. 2 months after he took office, Ronald Reagan was shot while leaving an event at a hotel in Washington. In the first moments, no one realized that he had been hit, but there was a bullet in his left lung, close to his heart. At the hospital, Reagan jokingly told the doctors, "I hope you're all Republicans." They were able to remove the bullet, and he made a full recovery. The gunman, 25-year-old John Hinckley Jr., was sent to a mental hospital. His explanation for the attack was that he was trying to impress the actress Jodie Foster.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.